Chapter 30 Albert Neary sat in his Bronx apartment and carefully brushed the blue serge of his old policeman's uniform. He unpinned the badge and set it on the table to be polished. The regulation holster and gun were draped over a chair. This old routine of detail made him happy in some strange way, one of the few times he had felt happy since his wife had left him nearly 2 years ago. He had married Rita when she was a high school kid and he was a rookie policeman. She was shy, dark-haired, from a straight-laced Italian family who never let her stay out later than 10 o'clock at night. Neary was completely in love with her, her innocence, her virtue, as well as her dark prettiness. At first, Rita Neary was fascinated by her husband. He was immensely strong, and she could see people were afraid of him because of that strength and his unbending attitude toward what was right and wrong. He was rarely tactful. If he disagreed with a group's attitude or an individual's opinion, he kept his mouth shut or brutally spoke his contradiction. He never gave a polite agreement. He also had a true Sicilian temper, and his rages could be awesome. But he was never angry with his wife. Neary, in the space of 5 years, had become one of the most feared policemen on the New York City force. Also, one of the most honest. But he had his own ways of enforcing the law. He hated punks, and when he saw a bunch of young rowdies making a disturbance on a street corner at night, disturbing passersby, he took quick and decisive action. He employed a physical strength that was truly extraordinary, which he himself did not fully appreciate. One night in Central Park West, he jumped out of the patrol car and lined up 6 punks in black silk jackets. His partner remained in the driver's seat, not wanting to get involved, knowing Neary. The 6 boys, all in their late teens, had been stopping people and asking them for cigarettes in a youthfully menacing way, but not doing anyone any real physical harm. They had also teased girls going by with a sexual gesture more French than American. Neary lined them up against the stone wall that closed off Central Park from 8th Avenue. It was twilight, but Neary carried his favorite weapon, a huge flashlight. He never bothered drawing his gun. It was never necessary. His face, when he was angry, was so brutally menacing, combined with his uniform, that the usual punks were cowed. These were no exception. Neary asked the first youth in the black silk jacket, "What's your name?" The kid answered with an Irish name. Neary told him, "Get off the street. I see you again tonight, I'll crucify you." He motioned with his flashlight, and the youth walked quickly away. Neary followed the same procedure with the next 2 boys. He let them walk off. But the 4th boy gave an Italian name and smiled at Neary as if to claim some sort of kinship. Neary was unmistakably of Italian descent. Neary looked at this youth for a moment and asked superfluously, "You Italian?" The boy grinned confidently. Neary hit him a stunning blow on the forehead with his flashlight. The boy dropped to his knees. The skin and flesh of his forehead had cracked open, and blood poured down his face. But it was strictly a flesh wound. Neary said to him harshly, "You son of a bitch, you're a disgrace to the Italians. You give us all a bad name. Get on your feet." He gave the youth a kick in the side, not gentle, not too hard. "Get home and stay off the street. Don't ever let me catch you wearing that jacket again either. I'll send you to the hospital. Now get home. You're lucky I'm not your father." Neary didn't bother with the other 2 punks. He just booted their asses down the avenue, telling them he didn't want them on the street that night. In such encounters, all was done so quickly that there was no time for a crowd to gather or for someone to protest his actions. Neary would get into the patrol car and his partner would zoom it away. Of course, once in a while there would be a real hard case who wanted to fight and might even pull a knife. These were truly unfortunate people. Neary would, with awesome, quick ferocity, beat them bloody and throw them into the patrol car. They would be put under arrest and charged with assaulting an officer. but usually their case would have to wait until they were discharged from the hospital. Eventually, Neary was transferred to the beat that held the United Nations building area, mainly because he had not shown his precinct sergeant the proper respect. The United Nations people, with their diplomatic immunity, parked their limousines all over the streets without regard to police regulations. Neary complained to the precinct and was told not to make waves, to just ignore it. But one night, there was a whole side street that was impassable because of the carelessly parked autos. It was after midnight, so Neary took his huge flashlight from the patrol car and went down the street, smashing windshields to smithereens. It was not easy, even for high-ranking diplomats, to get the windshields repaired in less than a few days. Protests poured into the police precinct station house demanding protection against this vandalism. After a week of windshield smashing, the truth gradually hit somebody about what was actually happening, and Albert Neary was transferred to Harlem. One Sunday shortly afterward, Neary took his wife to visit his widowed sister in Brooklyn. Albert Neary had the fierce protective affection for his sister common to all Sicilians, and he always visited her at least once every couple of months to make sure she was all right. She was much older than he was and had a son who was 20. This son, Thomas, without a father's hand, was giving trouble. He had gotten into a few minor scrapes, was running a little wild. Neary had once used his contacts on the police force to keep the youth from being charged with larceny. On that occasion, he had kept his anger in check, but had given his nephew a warning. "Tommy, you make my sister cry over you, and I'll straighten you out myself." It was intended as a friendly, pally uncle warning, not really as a threat. But even though Tommy was the toughest kid in that tough Brooklyn neighborhood, he was afraid of his Uncle Al. On this particular visit, Tommy had come in very late Saturday night and was still sleeping in his room. His mother went to wake him, telling him to get dressed so that he could eat Sunday dinner with his uncle and aunt. The boy's voice came harshly through the partly open door. "I don't give a shit, let me sleep." And his mother came back out into the kitchen, smiling apologetically. So they had to eat their dinner without him. Neary asked his sister if Tommy was giving her any real trouble, and she shook her head. Neary and his wife were about to leave when Tommy finally got up. He barely grumbled a hello and went into the kitchen. Finally, he yelled into his mother, "Hey, Ma, how about cooking me something to eat?" But it was not a request. It was the spoiled complaint of an indulged child. His mother said shrilly, "Get up when it's dinner time, and then you can eat. I'm not going to cook again for you." It was the sort of little ugly scene that was fairly commonplace, but Tommy, still a little irritable from his slumber, made a mistake. "Ah, fuck you and your nagging. I'll go out and eat." As soon as he said it, he regretted it. His Uncle Al was on him like a cat on a mouse. Not so much for the insult to his sister this particular day, but because it was obvious that he often talked to his mother in such a fashion when they were alone. Tommy never dared say such a thing in front of her brother. This particular Sunday, he had just been careless, to his misfortune. Before the frightened eyes of the two women, Al Neary gave his nephew a merciless, careful physical beating. At first, the youth made an attempt at self-defense, but soon gave that up and begged for mercy. Neary slapped his face until the lips were swollen and bloody. He rocked the kid's head back and slammed him against the wall. He punched him in the stomach, then got him prone on the floor and slapped his face into the carpet. He told the two women to wait and made Tommy go down the street and get into his car. There he put the fear of God into him. "If my sister ever tells me you talk like that to her again, this beating will seem like kisses from abroad," he told Tommy. "I want to see you straighten out. Now go up the house and tell my wife I'm waiting for her." It was 2 months after this that Al Neary got back from a late shift on the force and found his wife had left him. She had packed all her clothes and gone back to her family. Her father told him that Rita was afraid of him, that she was afraid to live with him because of his temper. Al was stunned with disbelief. He had never struck his wife, never threatened her in any way, had never felt anything but affection for her. But he was so bewildered by her action that he decided to let a few days go by before he went over to her family's house to talk to her. It was unfortunate that the next night he ran into trouble on his shift. His car answered a call in Harlem, a report of a deadly assault. As usual, Neary jumped out of the patrol car while it was still rolling to a stop. It was after midnight, and he was carrying his huge flashlight. It was easy spotting the trouble. There was a crowd gathered outside a tenement doorway. One Negro woman said to Neary, "There's a man in there cutting a little girl." Neary went into the hallway. There was an open door at the far end with light streaming out, and he could hear moaning. Still handling the flashlight, he went down the hall and through the open doorway. He almost fell over two bodies stretched out on the floor. One was a Negro woman of about 25. The other was a Negro girl of no more than 12. Both were bloody from razor cuts on their faces and bodies. In the living room, Neary saw the man who was responsible. He knew him well. The man was Wax Baines, a notorious pimp, dope pusher, and strong-arm artist. His eyes were popping from drugs now. The bloody knife he held in his hand wavered. Neary had arrested him 2 weeks before for severely assaulting one of his whores in the street. Baines had told him, "Hey, man, this is none of your business." And Neary's partner had also said something about letting the niggers cut each other up if they wanted to, but Neary had hauled Baines into the station house. Baines was bailed out the very next day. Neary had never much liked Negroes, and working in Harlem had made him like them even less. They were all on drugs or booze while they let their women work or peddle ass. He didn't have any use for any of the bastards. So Baines' brazen breaking of the law infuriated him, and the sight of the little girl all cut up with a razor sickened him. Quite coolly, in his own mind, he decided not to bring Baines in. But witnesses were already crowding into the apartment behind him, some people who lived in the building and his partner from the patrol car. Neary ordered Baines, "Drop your knife, you're under arrest." Baines laughed. "Man, you gotta use your gun to arrest me." He held his knife up. "Oh, maybe you want this." Neary moved very quickly, so his partner would not have time to draw a gun. The Negro stabbed with his knife, but Neary's extraordinary reflexes enabled him to catch the thrust with his left palm. With his right hand, he swung the flashlight in a short, vicious arc. The blow caught Baines at the side of the head and made his knees buckle comically like a drunk's. The knife dropped from his hand. He was quite helpless. So Neary's second blow was inexcusable, as the police departmental hearing in his criminal trial later proved with the help of the testimony of witnesses and his fellow policemen.